Star Wars Andor Episode 1, Cassa.
No weapons, no comms, no credit, no nonsense.
A friend of mine said there was a girl from Canary working here, looking for my sister.
People come and go. You should leave.
What was her name?
Nobody here gives their real name.
Excuse me, we were here first.
Oh, that is a hard look for a little thing like you.
Stop right there!
She's not breathing.
You've been very busy.
2 men are dead, sir. Employees. That's not worth staying up for, then I'm not worthy of the uniform.
I know one of these men. He was a squad commander on 4. One of the most unpleasant people I've ever met.
But they were murdered.
No, they were killed in a fight. They clearly harassed a human with dark features and chose the wrong person to annoy.
I have something to sell.
What?
I got an untraceable NS9 star pathionic. Your friend will want this piece.
Why is that?
Find it. Whatever it is, I want to know when it left and where it went.
Let's go!
Casa! There's an Ovisna! Whoa!
Let's dive into this first episode, and let me begin by reading a summary that, of course, I didn't come up with myself, but I stole it from Wikipedia. So thank you so much for those of you that have typed that on Wikipedia, because it's a great help. 5 years before the Battle of Yavin, Cassian Andor travels to the industrial planet of Morlana. He is on the trail of his missing sister. While searching for her in a brothel, another first in Star Wars, Cassian is antagonized by 2 pre-Moor Authority security officers. And this is the first time that we get introduced to this new type of, you know, kind of local authority. An altercation between the trio shortly ensues outside the brothel, leading to Cassian accidentally killing one officer and executing the other. That was pretty harrowing. It shows you immediately that this is a very kind of still rough version of Cassian, although in Rogue One, of which, of course, this whole series is a huge prequel, that also starts with Cassian just executing someone right there on the spot. Cassian then, after the execution, flees to the planet Ferrix, which is where he has lived for most of his life. At least that's what we know so far. And there he attempts to hide his involvement by convincing his adopted mother Marva's droid, B2EMO, or B2EMO, a fantastic new droid, I think, in the Star Wars collection of great droids, and also his friend Brasso to cover for him. Cassian also asks his friend Bix to connect him with a black market buyer, as Cassian has acquired a Starpath unit, a valuable piece of Imperial navigation technology. Bix agrees and contacts the buyer. And the buyer, of course, is going to be a very, very important character. We will discover that later. But her attempts to hide her connection with Cassian makes her boyfriend, Tim, suspicious. And that will have huge consequences. Back on Morlana 1, the Chief Inspector of Security elects to cover up the murders to improve his report to the Imperial authorities. But his deputy, the dutiful Cyril Karn, I hope I pronounced that correctly, one of my favorite characters, by the way, is determined to solve the case. Karn identifies Cassian's borrowed ship and traces it to Ferrix and learns from an eyewitness at the brothel that Cassian said that he was from the planet Canary. And that brings us to our first flashback where we see Cassian as a young child and we see where he comes from. And I assume that over the course of this series, we will discover much more about his backstory and how he ended up where he is at the beginning of this series, and also maybe some secrets of his past. This is all about what motivates him, what made him into the Cassian that we get to know. And maybe it will also have some clues that will come back later in his adult life that will ultimately bring him to the kind of the rebel side. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. So this flashback shows us a younger Cassian, known at the time as Cassa, also the title of the episode, and his tribe on Canary. And they decide to investigate a crashed ship. This is part of what we saw in the first trailer for, or the teaser trailer for Andor. Casa rebuffs his younger sister's efforts to join them, leaving her behind to guard their encampment. And that, of course, is going to be part of his big trauma, because he left his sister alone and he will never see her again. And now for the rest of his life until this moment, he's been searching for her. So I'm pretty sure that we will somehow learn more about her and what happened to her after what we saw in this flashback. All right, what were my first impressions? Well, of course, like everyone else, I was stunned to see how well this was filmed. The cinematography is definitely also among the best that I've ever seen in Star Wars. It feels very much like modern television. A lot of what we've seen so far, especially in Obi-Wan Kenobi and The Book of Boba Fett and The Mandalorian, it was all done with a relatively small budget, at least when you consider that this is Star Wars. And it was mostly filmed inside that virtual dome where they can use big screens that surround the actors to project all sorts of virtual environments, which of course is a fantastic technology, but also starts to show its limitations. You kind of start to feel that it's artificial, and that it's kind of small scale. Not so in Andor. I mean, the scope, the overall look, the opening scene, that felt very much like something out of Blade Runner. It's dark, it's raining, it's very atmospheric. You would never be able to do that inside the volume. That's how they call this virtual set technology. Because, you know, it's all technology. You cannot let it rain there on set. But they can do that here. And it so helps to set the mood. I also loved the dialogue, the quality of the dialogue writing, and also the execution of the dialogue. You've got some great actors. It all feels very natural, much more like, I don't know, like The West Wing or like another Sorkin series where there's fast-paced dialogue. There's not much. Usually Star Wars is very like solemn, like everything they say can be turned into a nice quote that fans like me learn by heart and will repeat the rest of their lives, mostly in inappropriate situations. But that's not the case with Andor. This is casual conversation. It feels very, very real. I love this whole new type of dialogue. Let's be honest, dialogue has always kind of been the weak point of Star Wars, especially when George Lucas was writing the scripts, because dialogue is just not his thing. I loved the feeling that you're stepping into a pre-established world. For instance, let me give you an example. You've got the wall where the workers will hang their gloves after they're done working, and they're all there. There's no explanation for that. But you can feel that this is something they've been doing for decades. This is like one part of the traditions. The bell guy, the other guy, we've seen the guy in the trailers, and there were lots of theories. Turns out we never get to know him. But we see him do his daily ritual, and it gives you the feeling that, wow, this is a world that has been there forever, and we're just stepping into a story that was already going on. That, to me, is very much Star Wars. That is what A New Hope did so well, where you just plunge into the story right away, but you realize, well, wait a minute, this story has been going on without me for a while. So I love that. I loved B2EMO. And also kind of the morally gray character of Cassian. You can clearly tell that this is the beginning of a story arc. And why is he so morally gray? Why is he so pragmatic? Has to do a lot with his traumas from the past, from his youth. Easter eggs. There's one Easter egg that I absolutely loved. On Chief Hine's desk in the Preox Morlana security office, you see his computer, and I immediately recognized, because I had that computer. It's a Tandy TRS-80 Model 3 or Model 4. That was a Radio Shack model computer. And that was my second computer. I learned how to program on those computers. And it was like, oh my gosh, I know that. I recognize this. Rogue One also did that. There is, at one point, you see like a Mulinex kitchen device in the background. And I'm sure that there are lots and lots of those Easter eggs. Feels very Star Wars to me. They often will just paint something in a different color, and all of a sudden, it is something inside. Think of the ice cream maker. You know, that became so iconic in Empire Strikes Back. My favorite scene to wrap things up, the corruption of the Empire versus the dutiful Cyril Karn. That is my absolute favorite moment in this first episode. Karn is clearly someone who takes pride in what he does. He even enhances his uniform, and then he's confronted with the lazy, pragmatic, kind of half-corrupt attitude of his superior, and you can tell that he doesn't want to go along with that. He feels that he's responsible. And, well, later on we will see, of course, that that is not actually recognized by the Empire. So that creates a very interesting tension between this guy who in a certain way is sympathetic. At least he's following his principles and his ideals. He's not corrupt. And he's driven. There's internal motivation. And not just someone who's following orders like most people in the Empire. And that makes him potentially a very, very dangerous guy. Because he's not just following orders. He isn't in it for the money. He's in there for the principle. And it's a great villain. Or potentially, I don't know, maybe he will turn to the rebels. That's also a possibility. But for now, I think he's definitely established as a future villain that will have a confrontation with Cassian at one point. Quote of the episode. As discussion of the episode, I want to talk about a favorite line or a few lines of dialogue. And in this case, it was the conversation between Cassian Andor and B2 EMO, where I'll just read it. "I know it takes a lot of energy, but can you make a lie for me? I can lie. I have adequate power reserves." I love also that he's stuttering a little bit, old technology. So he needs extra power reserves to lie. And then Cassian says, "Don't tell anybody you saw me. Don't tell anybody you know where I am." That's two lies. "Let's have both. I will have to recharge at home." It's kind of this very kind of cool humor, understatement of the year. But I also like that lying apparently costs more than telling the truth, even for droids. So there's a little bit of a moral lesson there as well. I love that. Now, what's the central theme in this first episode? I think what I would distill from this episode is the importance to not judge people just on the basis of their appearances. We get to meet Cassian, but we don't know his backstory. We may feel in a certain way about what he does and the choices that he makes, but we don't know what happened to him. And this is also true for his nemesis, or I'm just going to assume Karn is his, Cyril Karn is his nemesis. So where does this drive come from? Why is he so fixated on the rules, on his uniform, on his duty? Where does that come from? We will see in later episodes that also has to do a lot with his upbringing, with his childhood. And I like that because for me, this is essential to Star Wars. Star Wars, the name is about wars, but ultimately these stories are about peace. And how do you come together? How do you find each other? And it's also always by looking at the world, and more importantly, looking at people as real people and not just as something you use. The Empire is a metaphor for all those that are treating other people as things. As resources, as assets that you can manipulate, and what the contrast between the Empire and the Rebels is that in the Rebels doesn't matter where you're from, what your motivation is, how you got there, and we will see this also in the story of Cassian Andor. As long as you share this common ideal, everybody is welcome in the rebellion, and is valued as a person. And I think Cassian especially will have to learn that and will have to start to kind of open up, because he too, in a certain way, at the beginning of this story, is looking at everything in a transactional way. I'm just in it for the money. It's a bit like Han Solo in A New Hope. Just give me the reward and I'm out of here. And then you see that hanging out with these rebels has impacted his way of looking at the people around him, and he starts to care. And I think that is also something that we will see with a number of these characters in Cassian Andor. Let's move on to Star Wars Andor Episode too. That would be me.
Stop right there!
You're in primo corporate zone, you know that, right?
He's not breathing.
Probably more authority is seeking a Canary male resident of Ferex for questioning. Citizens with any information should contact the Priox Morlana Security HQ without any delay.
We have a suspect?
Cassian Andor. Insurrection, destruction of Imperial property, assault on an Imperial soldier. Who else knows that you were born in Canary?
Bubba Vix. Vix is looking for you.
Vix has nothing to do with
it. But then who told these Primo bastards about Canary?
Canary. Abandoned after Imperial mining disaster. Everyone died.
Andor should be considered armed and dangerous. He may not appear to be a formidable opponent, but two of our men are dead, having made that mistake.
I have something to sell.
What?
An untraceable MS-9 starport unit.
Do you know how much that's worth?
Yeah, enough to get out of here. Lay low till things cool off.
Your friend will want this piece. He'll come for this.
Let's talk about this second episode, and we will begin with a short summary of what this episode is about. This one comes from Wikipedia. It's very short. Tim, who is Bix's boyfriend, is still suspicious and envious of Bix's relationship with Cassian. And so he reports Cassian to Primor Security. Big catastrophic mistake, of course. And then the security issues a warrant for Cassian's arrest. Karn, Cyril Karn, partners with Mosk, an equally dutiful Primor officer, great character. And they team up with a few other officers to arrest Cassian. B2 Emo informs Cassian and Marva of the warrant. Marva is Cassian's foster mom. And did you know, I only discovered this very recently, that's the same actress who plays Aunt Petunia. You probably already knew that. But I was like, oh, that's Aunt Petunia from Harry Potter. She was great in Harry Potter, but she's equally great. She's a different, very different character here. But that's like, I was watching the episode. I was like, I know her. Where have I seen her before? And then only recently, I was like, oh my gosh. Harry Potter Star Wars crossover. How cool is that? Anyway, because there's now a warrant, Cassian has to escape and he prepares to flee the planet. Meanwhile, Bix's buyer travels to Ferex to obtain the Starpath unit. So Bix is kind of this part of this, what feels a bit like a romantic triangle. And this is very familiar to the Star Wars narrative. You had the same situation with Leia and then Luke and Han. However, if you've seen subsequent episodes, you know that this triangle is not going to last very long. But I wonder if we will see Bix back again. The story is multi-pronged and it goes in many different directions, which makes it kind of sometimes hard to keep track of how is everybody doing. I'd like to kind of go back to all these locations, all these characters in every episode, but the story doesn't do that. I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's continue to share what's in this episode. Then we get another flashback. Remember Casa and the other teenagers that are living together were investigating a crashed ship. We don't really know what happened to this ship or where they came from. Again, that's probably all backstory that will be revealed in future episodes. And this crashed ship, this is where we get to see a little bit more of the original Canary planet that Cassian is from. Turns out there is a huge abandoned industrial strip mining operation nearby, and then all the crew members are dead, and they have this very weird color. At first I was like, oh, they're alien, but I think what they're trying to convey is that they've been poisoned. It just altered their complexion. And so what's going on there? Who killed them? Who poisoned them? Who wanted that ship to go down? And then one of the crew members of the crashed ship is still alive. And when one of the teenage girls is approaching him, she gets shot. And then the tribe of the young people there kill the attacker and then run away from the crash site, except for Casa. So Cashin stays behind and explores the ship. And that's the end of the episode. And they're like, wow, okay, we've already seen a ton of footage that we've seen in the trailer, but now it's in context. Plus, it also kind of made me less anxious that they would have shown too much in the trailers. That's a current trend where, you know, a movie trailer will just spoil the whole plot. But I think that most of what we've seen in the teaser trailer and in the official trailer was from these first few episodes. So there's still a lot that we haven't seen so far. My first impressions, I really loved the fact that in this second episode already, you get very, very intense drama, especially when Tim betrays Cashin out of jealousy. Again, this is something that is not common in Star Wars, to get these complex relationships. Now, of course, that doesn't do justice to a series like The Clone Wars, for instance, where you get a lot of layered character exposition and evolution. But Clone Wars, that was multiple series, multiple seasons. They took their time to do that. Here, it feels like, even though we get a lot of episodes, Andor is a huge project, but I think that they're immediately going in depth with a drama like this. It's like a tragedy, where we know that Cashin is not having an affair with Bix. And so you kind of get that dread, like, oh my gosh, oh, he's going to tell the security guards, and of course they will probably know more about Cashin, and that this is going to have catastrophic consequences. And it's already at this point that I was like, I think he's going to pay for this, because betrayal out of fear is the worst thing you can do. You know, betray your friend, and it's all out of this again. Very Star Wars theme. Fear leads to the dark side. And in this case, kind of the moral dark side. There's no force talk here in these episodes. But it's the same idea. Like, he could have just asked Bix, hey, what's going on between you and Cashin? Just be honest with me. Instead, he follows her, he mistrusts her, he observes her, and he makes up this story in his mind, which of course is not the truth. But he convinces himself that it is, because he's driven by fear. It's easier to believe in the story, in his internal story, than to incur the risk of being rejected. Because that's ultimately, I think, what he fears. If he would confront Bix, she may tell him that, yeah, I'm in love with Cashin and it's over between us. And I don't think he wants that confrontation. So fear always leads to the dark side. I also really loved the chemistry between Karn and Sergeant Mosk, and then the rest of the team. I thought that the dynamic was great. Again, these characters are so real and so extremely well written. The dialogue's fantastic. The whole behavior, it's wow. I love it. None of these characters are archetypes or stereotypes. They all feel like people of flesh and blood, and I love that. And it's also kind of funny to see this kind of uptight Karn and then these hardened Primor officers that are like, yeah, we will just... Let us fix this job, you know. and it's also interesting that there is a bit of a developmental parallel between Cashin and Cyril Karn. That's why I think they will ultimately end up confronting each other, because you can tell that Cyril Karn is not fitting in with the other officers. He still has so much to learn. He's a bit like a weirdo. In this hardened, very experienced group of officers. And so is Cashin in a certain way. Already in his youth, on Canary, you can feel that he's a bit too young, he doesn't really fit in, and now in this story he's also a bit of a loner. His only family is his foster mom and father. But he doesn't seem to have a group that he belongs to. He's been on this solo quest for most of his life. So he's, just like Cyril Karn, unable to really relate to other people. And I guess that's going to be part of the story arc and of their character arc. I love how they did that this here. So Cashin wants to prove that he's worthy to the other kids that are the tribe that is exploring the crashed ship. And Cyril Karn also is trying to kind of puff himself up to show that he is worthy to hang out with these experienced officers. And in fact, he's in charge. He's got the lead. But of course, he has no experience. And Sergeant Mosk is kind of helping him. You know, let me just like, yeah, he's the boss. But don't listen to him. Listen to me. Follow my orders. We also finally get to see Ryle, who is looking for Cashin. And he, of course, story-wise, is the quest giver. He is going to be the one that will dare Cashin to choose the bigger goal, to stop being pragmatic and to invest in this bigger quest. And then, of course, you get that whole very classic character arc that you see in Star Wars, but also in a lot of other fairy tales and in mythological stories, even in biblical stories. You get the refusal of the call, the initial refusal. Like, yeah, that's not for me. I'm just here for the money. Just, you know, give me what you owe me, and I'm out of here. But of course, this quest giver, Ryle, wants much more of Cashin and knows Cashin much better than he knows himself. Great acting. Best Easter egg. Cashin carries, and I had to look this up because I didn't recognize it, but some of you actually did share with me that you did recognize this. He has a very specific weapon. It's a K-16 Briar pistol. And this was used in a very classic Star Wars video game that I think is going to get a remake, but I'm not sure. It's Star Wars Dark Forces. This is a computer game that I used to play as a student on an old Pentium computer. The game is from 1995. So that is... that's a long time ago. It was an amazing game. It was a bit like Doom, but instead of monsters, you would have stormtroopers. An awesome game. But apparently, so this pistol, this prop, is based on the gun from that video game. Awesome little Easter egg. There's not much fan service, but every once in a while, there will be these little things in the background. And I don't even think that it's the writers or the director who has inserted it. It's the props people. It's just the people that do the development of what the series looks like. And they're like, well, what if we model this on this video game? The real fans will notice it. But I like that these Easter eggs never are in your face. It's not like, hey, look at that cameo. You remember him, right? Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. No, it's all like, you miss it, not a problem. This is not a series about pleasing the fans. This is about telling a realistic story. Best quote. Before I get there, my favorite scene in this one was towards the end. It's Karn's motivational speech to the other Primor officers. Oh my god, that was so cringeworthy, and yet so sublime. This sublime execution, fantastically written, and you get you almost pity. Karn is like, oh, come on, guy. I know that you have to lead these officers, but please don't do the speeches. You still got a lot to learn. But he really wants to be the leader, but he also knows that, you know, he's the one with the least amount of experience. I thought that was a brilliant scene. So best quote. This is actually a quote from Cyril Karn. There comes a time when the risk of doing nothing becomes the greatest risk of all. In other words, doing nothing is also choosing. The Empire may think that they're above all that and, you know, they have everything under control. And so they can just, like his superior officer, you know, let's just falsify the reports so they don't bother us and we can just go on living our lives. Karn knows that that is ultimately going to have consequences. Not acting is definitely going to hit you in the back. And this is also something that will come back later on in one of the Imperial scenes, where there's this same idea of like, but rebellion, it's like a sickness. And if you're a doctor, you have to act. You cannot just sit back and see, well, maybe this will go over by itself. No, you have to do surgery. Otherwise, the thing will get out of hand and will grow much bigger. So anyway, interesting to see here. I think already maybe they're planting seeds that ultimately Karn will end up being an Imperial officer. He will, you know, go up in the ranks. But before, of course, you go up, first you need to go rock bottom. That will come later in Karn's story. But I'm already so much enjoying his story arc. I think that Karn is both sympathetic and dangerous because, as I said before, he is motivated from the inside and he thinks that he's on the right side of history. Morally corrupt people, like a lot of his superiors and a lot of people in the Empire, they're actually not as dangerous because they're corrupt. So they're also corruptible. But the ones that are really dangerous are the religious fanatics, like Darth Vader is perceived by his fellow Empire people. It's like the fanaticism, the interior motivation, that makes someone really unpredictable and also hard to control. Anyway, I also found an interesting quote in an interview with the actor who plays Karn, an actor called Kylie Soller. He revealed quite a bit about his character Cyril Karn that would prove to be valuable information in viewing who he is at his core. Quote from the interview: he has an extreme sense of need to impress, hence the motivational speech. But that is because he needs to fill a hole in himself. Interesting. So there is a hole, there is a trauma, there is brokenness that he needs to overcompensate. And so that is really about ascending to the top of whatever field he is in. The field he has chosen is one of restriction and complete control and one of domination. Basically, Cyril is incredibly ambitious and constantly looking for a way to become the best at what he does. Now, this makes me think that could lead him to become maybe a very high-ranking officer in the Empire, or maybe a very valuable asset for the rebellion. Is he going to turn in the end? He does have that sense of justice. He is outraged when he's confronted with the corruption and the laziness of his superiors. So maybe there is good in him. It's good in the wrong place. But he's seeking for something that I can get behind of. And that is, you know, you have to fulfill your duty. You have to be consistent and honorable and reliable. So, yeah, we'll see. And so what is ultimately the most important theme of this second episode? It's actually something that comes from medieval theology, believe it or not. Thomas Aquinas, who's one of the most important theologians in the Middle Ages, and maybe theologians in general for the Catholic tradition, Thomas Aquinas wrote that even people that are doing the wrong thing are still doing it because they seek to do good. It's just that their perception of what is good, how they identify the good, that's not the right thing. But nobody can act out of pure malevolence. And this is interesting because we've seen a lot of evildoers in Star Wars lore, like the Sith. And they seem, or Palpatine, they seem to be just motivated by pure evil. They're not even in it for the money, but they're just in it to do harm. That, Thomas Aquinas would say, is illogical. That's just not part of how we work. That's not how we work as humans. We always perceive a certain good, and then we act upon it. So we ultimately, everybody wants to do good, even horrible villains. The trick is, of course, to use the Force to be able to discern what is really good for you and for the world and for your neighbor and for your soul, maybe. And that's where oftentimes things go wrong, because fear can make you believe that something is good, whereas in the long run, it's actually completely wrong and morally wrong and destructive. But so everybody acts because they think they are doing what is good. There's always a reason for people to be evil. There's always a reason for why people's, I would say, conscience is misdirected. And a good story is about that. What made people act and make the choices that they make? And oftentimes, I would say always, the clues for our current behavior lie in our past, in our traumas, in our fears, in our upbringing. And so someone like Karn and someone like Cassian actually have a lot more in common than you'd think. But they've grown up in different environments, different upbringing. They've gone through different types of trauma, and that's how they end up at the opposite spectrum at one point. But ultimately, you could have inverted them, place Cassian in Karn's situation and Karn in Cassian's situation, and the roles would be inverted in the story as well. I love this. This is why Andor so far is... I'm impressed by the depth of the character development. It's time to talk about episode 3, The Reckoning.
Primo Enforcement put out a bulletin last night for someone meeting Cassian's description.
The bulletin doesn't mention him by name. It says they're looking for someone from Canary.
Andor should be considered armed and dangerous. He may not appear to be a formidable opponent, but two of our men are dead, having made that mistake.
Who are you?
I know all about you. Yes, I want the box, and I'll leave with that if it's all I can get. I know you killed two corpus at Morlana One, and I know they're coming for you. Seems like such a waste to let them have you. A waste of talent.
We have a warrant for Cassian Andor.
Brace yourself.
Let's go.
How many are you? 12. 14.
I swear. I'd like you to come with me.
Why would I go anywhere with you?
Don't you want to fight these bastards for you?
So what happens in episode 3 of Andor? Here's a short summary that I found online. Ryle arrives on Ferrix and meets Cassian in an abandoned factory. This is a scene that we've seen even before the release of the first two episodes. They showed this as a short, like, teaser. Like, this is the kind of action that you can look forward to. And this is really an action scene, which is a little bit, I would say, that's not really Andor so far. Because this series, I think, distinguishes itself from other Star Wars properties by its slow burn pace. It's sometimes it's very slow, and it took me a while to get used to that pace. I like it because it's different, but there are moments in this story where I like, okay, we need some action. Well, this beginning of this third episode definitely gives us the action. This is also something, and they've explained this, they will build up the story in 3-episode story arcs. And so this being the introduction to the story and to the characters, this third episode, Reckoning, is going to be the conclusion of what they set up in episode 1 and episode 2. So what happens in this abandoned factory? Karn and Mosk also arrive on the planet. They've got that warrant. And Karn, of course, kind of knows that Cassian is behind what's been happening, and he wants to capture Cassian. So they arrive there with a dozen security officers. They confront Marva, so the foster mother of Cassian, but she refuses to cooperate. I loved her calmness. She's just sitting there. She's seen it all. She's very experienced, and she uses words to unsettle these officers. I thought it was, again, brilliant writing, very subtle acting. I loved it. Then Karn intercepts a transmission from Cashin to B2EMO, which was kind of imprudent of him to just, like, talk into his little communicator. And then, of course, these droids, they will just air it. They won't process it internally. No, they have the speaker on. So that's how they can pinpoint Cashin's position. Cashin wants to sell the Starpath unit and what's his name? Rael. And then leave Ferrix with the money, probably to continue his quest to find his sister. But Rael tries to persuade him to join the Rebel Alliance, citing Cashin's repeated success at stealing from and sabotaging Imperial ships. So Cashin is an asset, and he came there not for the Starpath unit. He came there for Cashin. So this is the moment of the quest giving, right? This is your calling. It's much bigger than you thought your calling actually was. But let me tell you, I need you to come with me. Parallel to, for instance, Luke's calling. I need you to come with me to Alderaan. But I can't go. I need to be here. I need to help Uncle Owen. Maybe next year. No, I need... Your destiny is much bigger than your life here on Tatooine. Here, same thing. Cashin, I need you. Your life is about more than just trying to find your sister. Don't do all the little breadcrumb stuff. Or if you want to go to another totally different franchise, think of Bilbo's calling. You know, you are a good thief. As a hobbit, I need you for something way bigger than your life here in the Shire. Yeah, but I don't want to go. No, I don't want to have anything to do with these dwarves. Just leave me alone. This is my life. And then the next morning, Bilbo's like, yeah, I need to go. So you get that same dynamic. It's very classic storytelling. It's part of the hero's journey, of course. When Karn's officers raid the factory, the two men escape back to Marva's house, where they subdue Karn. This is a very humiliating scene for Karn, which, of course, he now has seen Cashin, his nemesis, and he will not forget. Because this was supposed to be his moment of glory, where he will successfully lead the other officers to capture this dangerous rebel spy or whatever he identifies Cashin with, and the opposite happens. He's humiliated, and he could have been executed. When Bix then learns that Tim informed on Cashin, she rushes to aid him, only to be stopped by the officers, who then kill Tim when he attempts to intervene. Tim, of course, realizes what he has done. He tries to make amends by intervening, and he has to pay with his life. I mean, I was sitting there and watching the drama unfold. It's like, oh, dude, why did you ever betray your friend Cashin? You didn't even know what was going on. You were just acting out of jealousy. Love makes people blind. And it's this tragedy, because Bix was like, I want to be with you tonight, right? Again, first for Star Wars. But, and then you can see that Tim is all distraught. It's like, oh, but I thought you were in love with Cashin. What have I done? And it slowly starts to dawn upon him, and then he has to pay for his mistake with his life. That shows you real drama, and it just shows how far this series wants to go. Of course, this also destroys Bix. She realizes what he has done, and she too is like, not only has she lost her boyfriend, and she discovers his mistrust, and that he actually thought that she was having an affair, but she also loses him for good. There's no way to heal, to mend this. It's horrible what happens. I was in shock. The officer who fired the shot is then sent back to the pod on which the security officers arrived, but the pod is destroyed after takeoff due to sabotage by Brasso. I hope that we will see all these people on Ferrix again in future episodes. Ryle and Cassian escape the planet, leaving a stranded Karn and Mosk behind. And then we get another flashback. Third time in a row that we get a flashback. It structurally reminds me a bit of what they did with Boba Fett in those first few episodes. We constantly get these flashbacks that give us a little bit more layers of the main character. In this flashback, we see Marva and her husband Clem. Interesting, Clem. Remember that name, because that name will return later on. And they scavenge the crashed ship on Canary and then discover this child, teenager, Casa, who out of rage because one of his tribe members has been killed, is trying to destroy the ship. And Marva, on the spot, decides that they need to take Casa with them, because otherwise the Republic will discover what has happened and you know, Casa will not survive it. So and this is terrible, of course. They take Casa with them, not knowing that he has a sister who's left behind. So yeah, that's gonna give some interesting, you know, mommy and daddy issues later on, I think, for Cassian. But we don't see any of that. But this shows us how he got away from Canary. And also, what was a bit confusing, I would say, let's go over to my first impressions. That last scene, even though I liked it, the flashback, it was a bit confusing because Marva looked very similar to what she looked on Ferrix. And so you're like, okay, what's happening? And then you realize, oh, wait a minute, this is a flashback. So you get to see her a little bit younger, but still looking mostly the same. But anyway, that was easily solved later on. You start to understand, okay, this is a flashback. I really liked that this felt like a mini finale. There was a big action scene. There was also a very good cliffhanger in the flashback. I loved all the action on Ferrix. I loved the drama. Cassian, for the first time, also establishes his credentials as a thief and spy. He understands the ones that he steals from. And he says the arrogance of the Empire makes them blind. So this is why Ryle needs Cassian, because Cassian is a good thief. Because he knows his enemy, and that's a quality that Ryle needs for his future plans. We don't know exactly what those plans are, but we will discover that in the next, let's say, trilogy of episodes that will follow in the subsequent week. As I already said, this is a very important episode structurally, because this is the definitive call to action. Or you could say the vocation of Cassian, and of course his initial refusal, and then reluctantly he goes along. And that reluctance will stay with Cassian for a while, but ultimately, of course, this will become his life-defining quest in life. But it's cool to see the early beginnings of that. No one is a rebel hero from the get-go. You become that hero over time, because you get more and more involved in the people that form the rebellion. Favorite Easter egg? One of the citizens who rings the alarm, so when the officers arrive, everybody starts clanking on metal. One of those people, one of those townspeople, is in fact none other than Dave Filoni. He was wearing a red trimmed outfit. I love these little, you know, guest roles. And of course, they're filming that. Not everything close to where Filoni works, because I think they built the entire village that we see on Ferrix was built in England or in Scotland, if I'm not mistaken. So this must have been during one of the visits of Dave Filoni. Dave Filoni is, of course, not a writer in this series, But I'm sure that he enjoyed the little trip to see the sets, and you know, why not give him a role? This is what Peter Jackson also did in the Fellowship of the Ring. So yeah, loved it. My favorite scene was definitely this whole, you know, clanking on metal plates. How this entire town rallies against the security officers, but they don't do it with violence. There's this eerie sound that they make, and which is actually super effective, because these officers are starting to like, oh, what's going on? And what I like is that it kind of continues this theme of making sound by metal on metal that we see with the big bell tower guy, right? So apparently sound is very important in the culture, and they don't explain it, which makes it feel so real, because this is obviously something they've been doing for years, if not decades, to warn everybody. If all communications go down, as long as you can hear, you can warn others. And I thought it was powerful. It was also cool to see how in a situation of oppression, everybody has a common enemy. And so when you need one another, the village is there for them. This is what Star Wars is ultimately all about. It's how having this common enemy binds people together. The Force is strong in families. And ultimately, this is also, this whole village is a family in a certain way. Best acting, definitely the moment between Bix and Trim, when Trim dies, and then Bix's, you know, emotion, her heartbreak. I thought it was stunning and incredible acting. Amazing. A favorite quote has to be from Marva. When the warning bell sounds, that is what a reckoning sounds like. The strength is in people coming together, which is symbolized by this increasing sound of the bells. It reminded me a little bit of a moment where I was in Rome, and I was there because the Pope was very sick. And then I'd been on St. Peter's Square for hours, and everybody expected the Pope to die at one point, of course, but nobody, of course, knew when that was going to happen. So I went back to the place where I was staying and to grab something to eat. I'd been standing on St. Peter's Square for hours and hours. I was tired and hungry. And then I heard the bells being tolled, but there was no mass or whatever that was announced. And then another church tower started to toll the bells. And then I ran up the stairs to the roof of the building where I was staying. And then the entire city below, Rome, every bell tower was tolling the bells. Churches, but also governmental buildings. And that sound was, this increasing sound of all these bells was the announcement that everybody had to come together because the Pope had died. And this is what this scene evoked to me. And that's also why it had such an emotional impact on me. It was like, oh, I know exactly how that feels. In this case, of course, it was not the sound of reckoning, but it was the sound of an entire country and maybe an entire church worldwide that was all realizing that this was an historic moment. I'll never forget it. What is the ultimate, the theme of this third episode? I would say it's compassion, which is a fundamental theme in Star Wars. George Lucas has said it multiple times. Star Wars is ultimately about compassion. That is maybe the true force. And it's the inability of the Empire to be compassionate, to actually care, versus the rebels, who really care so much for the future of their children, of generations to come, that they are willing to give their life for that cause. Compassion can turn people into martyrs, into voluntary martyrs. So there's incredible force in compassion. And in this episode, it's, I think, Marva's compassion for young Cassian She knows that it's a huge risk to bring him along. She doesn't even know this child, but she knows that this is a moment where you have to let your heart speak. And that ultimately, let's not forget, her compassion will have incredible consequences for the future, because it's because of this moment of compassion, decades before Luke is going to attack the Death Star. But if she hadn't shown compassion to this child at that moment, the destruction of the Death Star may have never happened. It's kind of the butterfly effect. If you want to compare this to Bilbo's story in The Lord of the Rings, or in The Hobbit, I should say, it's this moment where Bilbo is invisible, and there is Gollum, who's right there in front of him, and Gollum is trying to kill Bilbo, and Bilbo has a sword, and he is able to end it there and then, to get rid of this horrible creature. But then compassion takes over, and he spares the life of Gollum. And we know, of course, if that wouldn't have happened, Frodo would have never made it to Mount Doom. And ultimately, Frodo is not the one who destroys the ring. It's Gollum. And so again, compassion has this ripple effect in history that will ultimately, in these stories, will lead to redemption. That's how strong compassion is. And so I'm not surprised that George Lucas emphasizes the importance of compassion so much. That wraps it up for my thoughts on episode 3 of Andor. Let me know your thoughts in the comments, and I'll be back with episode 4.